Hello, friends, and welcome to a new season, a new episode of the Stir Crazy Podcast. I'm Rob Nelson, and today I'm joined by Carly Kramer, the Director of Education at Stir Museum.
Hello, happy to be here and happy to talk about the Olympics. This is going to be a gold medal worthy podcast.
I hope so. I hope at least we make the podium with this one.
Exactly. On that note, I have a question for you, Rob.
Yes, hit me.
What is the best part of an Olympic boxer's joke?
I don't know. What?
The punchline.
Yeah, that's thank you for that, Carly. Those are the sort of gold medal tactics that we hope will entice you to tune into our podcast weekly. Why don't I hit you with one, Carly?
Ah, yes.
What did the spotted cat get disqualified from during the Olympics?
I don't know.
He was a cheetah.
Ah.
So without much further ado, why don't we jump into the content of this podcast, which is the history of the Olympic Games, dating all the way back to ancient Greece and coming all the way up to the present.
You'll learn a lot, and there will be an option for audience participation with a fun little game show moment in the middle that we're going to try out.
So let's dive right in.
Oh, wow.
Off to the races.
Okay, bye.
Hello again, and welcome to a new season of the Stir Crazy Podcast. As always, I am Rob Nelson, and today I'm joined with Carly Kramers and Sam Stump from the Stir Museum staff and various departments. Thank you both for being on the podcast.
Hello, hello.
Thanks for having us. This seems like it'll be a fun topic, and it's topical with the times.
Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely. As Carly alluded to, we are today discussing the history of the Olympics then and now. This is a huge topic that could take several angles, but I think we followed a format that I think is going to be really enjoyable and hit up some of the key points throughout history. The first question I would like to pose to the group is just how long have the Olympic Games been around? Have they been continuous or interrupted? And what's the story there?
Well, they've been around since 776 BC, so if anyone wants to do that math for exactly how many years that's been around for, but even if you do that math, it's not going to be the most accurate, being that it was kind of on and off there for a little bit, and it started just kind of as something small, and then it grew from there, and it continued until Emperor Theodosius I came in with Christianity and realized the Olympics were kind of very Zeus and pagan based, so he kind of cut those off around 394 AD. So they had a stint there, and then they went away for a little bit, kind of sprinkled in once in a while, and then they got back in the game in 1896.
Yeah, a very large absence of about 700 years. Mm-hmm. Until they come back with authority in 1896, which just so happens to be a decade that Stir Museum here represents in our railroad town, and then the history that our museum interprets, which is the 1890s.
Yep, that means we should have a railroad town Olympic team, right?
We should. Stay tuned. Stay tuned for that.
Okay. That sounds great.
How do those games differ from the contests of old, as it were?
So the games used to be way more violent. We gotta love that Greek sense of conquering and competitiveness, and then when the Romans got involved, all that violence only heightened. And granted, the violent nature of it did help increase the popularity, but some examples of the violent nature is when you would have chariot and horse races, they would crash and get horse pileups and people would die. Boxers originally tied leather around their knuckles to make it so that it was more painful. And then when the Romans got into it, they were like, what if we make full gloves made of leather and then add spikes? So that heightened a little bit. And then they also, when they would do wrestling, that often ended in either one of the two wrestlers dying or until one of them surrendered by putting one finger up, which was like equivalent to tapping out. And there is actually on record, there was a wrestler who was dead and won because he broke his opponent's foot on his way down to dying, and the pain made the opponent say, I surrender, and then realized that the opponent was dead, but still won, technically. So,
fantastic.
Yeah. You don't really see those today, at least as far as I know.
As long as you don't tap out, you win.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't tap out if you're dead.
Yes.
One of the things that I was interested to find was the connection to, like, sort of commercialism of the ancient games, and how the Olympics were sort of directly tied to the first athletes who were paid for their performances as athletes. The word athlete is actually an ancient Greek word that means one who competes for a prize. It comes from two words, athlos, meaning contest, and athlon, meaning prize. So dating all the way back then, we're talking about athletes competing for various gifts for their endeavors. I looked at some of the things for Olympic winners during the ancient times, but what they did receive as victors were huge cash rewards. According to the Roman historian Plutarch, who wrote in 600 BC, a cash reward of 500 drachmae, the currency of that period, was a literal fortune and was given to one victor. From one Athenian inscription from the 5th century BC, there was one Athenian Olympic victor who received a free meal in the city hall every day for the rest of his life.
Wow.
Sort of a courtesy and a pension plan sort
of
thing.
I'll take that prize.
So yeah, all kinds of fun things like that. There was a lot of athletes who were really counting on, you know, being that hometown local kid who competed in the big show in Olympia. And if they won one event, but sometimes you needed to win three events, I hear, they could count on a sculpture being made by a artist that would bear their likeness for their hometown or outside of the temple where the Olympics were held. So
that's a wild prize. Yep.
That's the version of the Wheaties box for the time, I
think. Yeah, I guess so.
I made a note that said, fame and supreme glory were the true prize all along.
Just essentially retirement for life. It kind of...
Yeah.
And it's interesting that that was like the commercialism aspect back then. I mean, those were the paid athletes, whereas when it came back around in 1896, so the guy that mainly was the pioneer of that was Baron Pierre de Coubertin, and he was really strict about the athletes that were competing were unpaid non-professional athletes. So it's kind of funny how the only paid athletes the first time around with the Olympics were the Olympians, and then they only wanted unpaid athletes the second time around, and then you would get diploma and medal, and originally it was silver medal was the first. They didn't have gold, and then they would give you a little olive crown to kind of tie into the first ones, but it was really strict. They would have some athletes that would go under fake names and pretend like they were not paid athletes to get in there, and there was James Thorpe. He was a big controversy where he got a prize, and the king said, "You are the greatest athlete in the world," and he said, "Thanks, king." That's a quote. And he literally just said, "Thanks, king," which I don't know what else you're supposed to say if you get called the greatest athlete in the world by someone. And then it got discovered that he was a professional baseball player. And that haunted him for the rest of his life, where people could tell that he would still have emotional spouts where someone would see him crying and he would say, "I deserved that." And then 30 years after his death, he got it back.
Yep.
But poor dude.
He was the first Native American to win gold for the U.S.
There's a long history that we can get into with just the Olympics in general that kind of represent those progress, social progress movements in American history. That's one of them, the story of Jim Thorpe. Not necessarily the best story in terms of vacating his medals, but still an Olympic champion nonetheless. There are some other like great stories that involve like the first, you know, female winners, the first African-American winners. Do we want to get into that a little bit and just kind of jump around?
So yeah, going back with that Baron Pierre Coubertin, it's also contrasting with how his idea of sports was about peace and harmony and a gentlemanly honor competition. So having that kind of helped lead the way for having more openness to the Olympics going forward. You know, how just one example is there was the refugee team that was created in 2015, consisting of 10 athletes who were refugees from different places. And, you know, things like that and everywhere in between, having that kind of message with the rebirth of the Olympics of this is about the humanity of all these people coming together from different places to compete. I think that helped with the progression of things.
What is the story with the first U.S.-American team in those 1896 games? Because I know you took some time investigating that and came up with a pretty cool fun fact of the day.
Yes, the unlucky 13 in 1896. So when word got over to the U.S. about these games happening, there really wasn't a huge amount of interest. People were like, it's probably going to come back once and then not come back ever again. Big deal. But there were some athletes that were from Ivy Leagues, like Harvard and Princeton, that decided, hey, I want to do this. But they didn't have any financial support from America. But they got together and they decided they were going to do this. And they thought, okay, the games are going to start April 18th. So we'll plan to get like a couple of weeks beforehand. So then that way we can prep and then everything will be all good. Well, turns out that because the Greeks follow the Julian calendar, not the Gregorian calendar like us, that the Olympic Games actually started on April 6th.
Ah,
so,
whoops.
Yep, that was a fun surprise for them after their 16-day journey on not a great boat that was pretty small and wasn't really super meant for people to travel that far with that amount. But they got there April 5th and they said, uh-oh, it's tomorrow. So they had a fun time with that. But they actually did have some triumphant moments. So, for example, there was James Connolly, who was from Harvard, and he left Harvard saying, I'm going to go do this. And they said, well, if you do this, you're basically dropping out. And he said, I don't care. Like, if you're not supporting me, supporting my country in these games, then I just don't want to go to your school anymore, and I'm not coming back. So he went, and he actually got he did triple jump, and he got 44 feet, 11 and 3/4 inches, and got a victory there. So that was pretty cool. But then even cooler in my mind is Robert Garrett. So he decided that he wanted to perform in the discus competition, but he couldn't find a discus around Princeton. And so he commissioned a local blacksmith to forge one. And he found a description from a second century Greek writer, Lucian. And it just says, a lump of brass, circular and not unlike a small shield. So the blacksmith made something like that, and it ended up being 20 pounds. And so Garrett was like, this is too heavy. I'm not doing this. I'm dropping out of that competition.
Oh, no.
But then when they got there, and he found a discarded discus on, like, the side of the road somewhere, and he picked it up, and he said, it's only 5 pounds? I can do this.
Fantastic.
And so he did it, and people were so shocked because, I mean, he walked in. He looked scraggly. Like, he looked hungry. Just not wearing great clothes for this. And then he kicked butt. And
like an American.
There we go. By his bootstraps. So, yeah.
Just scraggly walked in, just looking hungry and ready to win.
America.
Okay.
So, yeah, he walked away with 4 medals. So I just thought that was, what a fun emotional journey for all those men to be on.
I know. John Baxter Taylor Jr. was the first African American to win an Olympic gold medal. But the first black athlete to compete in the Olympics was French soccer player Constantine Enriquez de Zuberia. He was born in Haiti and was the first person of color to win a gold medal when the French team won the first rugby Olympic tournament.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fantastic. I did know that John Taylor won a gold medal as a member of the 1600 meter relay team at the Games in London. That was in 1908. Mm-hmm. So that was part of a relay team that won a gold medal. I looked up and found that the first African American to win an individual Olympic gold medal didn't happen until 1924 in an individual event, and it was in a long jump where William DeHart Hubbard of America jumped 24 feet, 5 1/8 inches, which was just 1 foot short of the Olympic record at that time. Writing a letter to his mother at the time, he wrote, at last, I am ready to depart for Europe. It has taken years of hard work to get this far, but I am nearing my ultimate goal. And then he ultimately did it. So that was a fun story that I found.
There you go.
I also think there's a lot of cool stories that involve women.
Yep.
They weren't allowed to compete in the ancient Olympics. Actually, there was a separate Olympics for women.
Hera Games.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And maybe we can circle back to that in a moment. But in 1896, there were no female competitors, if my memory serves. But in 1900, there were. And the first woman to win an Olympic gold medal took place in those games in 1900.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a great story. I'm going to butcher this name because it's a real doozy. The Countess Helene de Portalales, who was an American-born Swiss woman, actually competed for the Swiss in the Olympics as a sailor, and she was not part of a women's team. She competed with her husband, who was the helmsman of the ship, and the nephew of her husband, whose name was Bernard de Portalais, and they actually won the 1 to 2 ton sailing event in that competition. So the first gold medal winner of, as a woman, 1900 games in sailing.
Wow.
Any other fun ones you guys care to mention?
Yes, I did have another one. The first black woman to win an Olympic gold medal was Alice Coachman in 1948.
Wow.
The following up to that, in 1948, were the first to feature the Paralympic Games.
Yeah. Mm.
And it was used as a way of opening up competition to war veterans.
That kind of segues us into a topic I wanted to bring up, and that's the Special Olympics and their history. Did either of you come across anything that struck you about the history of that topic?
Yeah. I mean, it started August 12th, 1968 in Washington, D.C. by Eunice Kennedy Shriver.
Yep.
That name sounds familiar because she was part of the Kennedy family. But her whole life, she was a huge advocate of people with intellectual disabilities and, you know, the perception that people had back then of people that weren't the neurotypical. It wasn't very humane, and she thought that they should be given opportunities. They should be treated just like every other human. So,
Imagine that.
Right? What a concept.
Right.
So, I mean, now today there's 5.5 million athletes that are involved in that. It makes a huge difference.
Her concern, too, stemmed from her sister, Rosemary, who was intellectually challenged. And they grew up doing sports together, but there were no programs for Rosemary to be able to compete in.
Yeah, as Carly was saying, in 1968 were those first games, but they actually originated from Eunice Kennedy Shriver's own backyard. She held a day camp in her backyard throughout the 1960s and kind of built that program to where it ultimately took the form in 1968 and, you know, just hit a jump-off point from there, and it's been a great event that's been hosted since that time. Later in the podcast, in the next segment, we're going to be talking with a representative from the Special Olympics in Nebraska, whose name is Nate Parks, and he is the vice president of the program here in the state. So I'm looking forward to that conversation as well.
Yeah.
At this moment, though, I want to kind of shift gears and try out something new for the podcast, and that is to ask both of you a few multiple choice questions that I think are pretty fun and might get some good answers that are just related to the history of the Olympics.
If we aren't correct, do we get fired from working at a history museum?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I'm batting 1,000 today, so I'm definitely not going to make it through this.
Rob has the pink slips in his pocket.
Exactly. Here they come.
All right.
Anyway, I have three questions.
Pop quiz.
Question the first. Everyone is familiar with the logo of the Olympics, but do you know what the history of the colored intertwined rings symbolize? Do they symbolize A, the five continents competing in the games, B, the rings being a symbol of the ancient Greek city-states, C, the rings symbolize the first Olympic events ever held in Olympia, Greece, or D, the logo represents the five nations who won the most Olympic medals in the 1896 competition?
Oh, goodness.
Okay, we expect everyone to be playing along at home also.
Uh-huh. Yep.
We're not just thinking in our heads. We're giving you a chance to think. Don't use your phones. That's cheating. We're not using ours. I am going to guess option C, that it represented the first games, because I did find one piece about how the second step as they were building up the Olympics after just having small foot races, which were the start of it, they had a pentathlon that had the long jump and the discus and the javelin toss, wrestling, and foot race. So because of my prior research, I am going to guess that.
Okay.
I would also like to guess that.
Copycat.
But I think, I don't want to copy you, so I'm going to go with B, which as I believe was the, did you say four original nations?
Five original Greek city-states?
Five original Greek city-states. Both? I don't know where I got four. That's not in there.
Both good guesses, both wrong answers.
Oh,
perfect.
We're fired,
Tim. The correct answer was A, they represent the five continents competing in the games.
Okay. I got that mixed up with B. I mixed those around in my head. That's what I wanted.
The five colors from left to right are blue, yellow, black, green, and red. The symbol expresses the activity of the union of five continents and their athletes throughout the Olympic Games, essentially.
Okay. I hate that my own notes gave me a red herring.
It wasn't invented until 1913, though, so it eliminates a couple of those other answers.
That's fair.
But I'm pretty good at writing wrong answers.
I've got
a long history and a lot of report cards that can reflect that.
Oh, boy.
So you ready for the second question?
Oh, there's a second one.
Yes.
Oh,
okay.
Boy.
Who was the first Olympian to be featured on the Wheaties box? Was it A, Jesse Owens, B, Mary Lou Retton, C, Bob Richards, or D, Christy Yamaguchi?
I was really hoping one of those options was going to be like Simone Biles.
Oh,
That's the only Olympian I really get to like keep up on, although obviously would not be correct.
Very much too recent.
Many reasons.
Yep. I'm going to go, I'm going to start first. I'm going to go with A, Jesse Owens, because that's the first name that came to mind to me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I'm going.
That's Jesse. Also where I'm going. I do not know if Wheaties were around that long ago. Probably were, maybe not. We'll find out. Those are our final answers, Rob. Yep.
Okay. Again, you are both wrong.
Dang it.
The correct answer was Bob Richards, who was the first to appear on a Wheaties box in 1958 after winning two gold medals for pole vaulting in consecutive Olympic Games in 1952 and 1956. All of the other people that I mentioned were also Olympic athletes, but they did not necessarily all end up on the Wheaties box.
That's fair.
Maybe I should have made it a little bit easier just so everyone would have felt better.
No, you're good.
You know, he pole vaulted his way onto the Wheaties box.
He was eating his Wheaties. Do we have a third chance
to redeem
ourselves?
We have a third chance. One last try here.
Third time's a charm.
Which of these games were never played in a past Olympic Games?
Okay.
A, the tug of war. B, solo synchronized swimming. C, live pigeon shooting. Or D, darts.
I don't get how you can solo synchronize swimming.
Yeah, that's
I think that's just swimming.
I got caught up on that. So I'm going to go with solo synchronized swimming.
That's our final answer.
That is also incorrect.
How? Who did this?
How do you do solo synchronized?
It was an individual swam to their own music.
It's called dance swimming.
I mean, they do have figure skating.
That's not synchronized figure skating.
I'm just trying to make a comparison. The correct answer
We're
is actually
athletes.
The correct answer is actually D, darts, has never been in the Olympics, although there is a huge movement right now and a groundswell to include it in future games. And they're kind of on the ballot to be on the 2024 list of games to participate in for the first time. So we'll be seeing more of that. I'm surprised no one guessed live pigeon shooting.
No, that felt right.
Oh, okay.
that felt right. It was like, oh yeah, I'm sure they definitely shot pigeons.
Yeah,
if they were willing to punch each other with spikes, I'm pretty sure they had no qualms with shooting pigeons.
Right, at some point in history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was only when I was doing research that only took place once or twice in the early 1900s, 1904 or 08 games.
Well, how long did solo synchronized swimming take place?
I actually think it was pretty long. I want to say until 1994 or 1990 that was still an event.
Wow.
Not to say that it went on for 50 years before that, but it was at least happening in the 90s.
I guess, when I thought about the word synchronized, I figured that meant that you had to have more than one person.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Not synchronized to the music so much. So, I get you.
It's kind of an oxymoron.
It makes sense.
Yeah, it didn't have a long stint. It was a sport at the Olympic Games between 1984 and 1992.
Okay, so three times.
Yeah.
So this article says, offended competitors.
No, I mean, this topendsports.com article says, it is surprising that it took the organizers three Olympics to realize that a person swimming alone cannot be synchronized with anyone else.
Oh, hey, we're right.
But it's synchronized to the music.
Synchronized to the music.
Yes.
Hey,
learn
you're
something
talking
new every day.
You are scoffing at greatness. There are currently three people on Earth who have a gold medal. They are better than anyone else
on
this planet.
I apologize.
They're gonna
solo
write
synchronized swimming.
No, I know. I already said we were offending them for sure.
If you
with our inability to understand synchronized swimming.
Yes, I mean, they can write in to this podcast and I will give them a personal apology.
Well, I'm gonna sort of combine my last question and then we'll take a break and shift gears. But I guess I'll ask the both of you to answer. Do you either have a favorite tidbit of history that we haven't talked about the Olympics, or do you have a favorite event that you look forward to every summer or winter games?
I think curling. is very fun. I think it'd be really great to aspire to be on the U.S. curling team.
I think that's everybody's goal. I don't know. I feel like that's the recycled line that I hear.
Sorry, I'm not original, Rob. But I don't know. After hearing that there is a movement for darts to become an Olympic sport, what if we really push for cornhole? Cornhole can be the next.
I've seen curling. It on ESPN before. That's a big deal.
That's something I can be on.
I'm sorry. I've just heard from like no fewer than 15 people in my life. Like, I'm gonna train. Yeah. I'm gonna be on this curling.
And my dad has stated that too. He like, said he curling, wants to be a curling champion.
It takes skill, but it's the most accessible. You know, mm-hmm. where I don't have to be able to do a million flips in the air to do it. I just have to be able to brush ice and think about physics a little bit.
Well, I mean, if you're any good at shuffleboard, it's essentially the same concept of just judging. You know, speed mm-hmm. and distance of a rock that, you know, you're letting go. But
yeah.
Anyway, Sam, how about you?
I've got three answers to that last question.
Wow, okay, hit me.
So what I am really enjoying this Olympics is watching the new skateboard competitions.
Mm. Oh.
I think that's fantastic that they added skateboarding.
Like, and, is it like an X Games sort of thing?
No, it's skills. It's more, as far as what I've been watching, it's more of tricks and showing off your ability. I enjoy watching volleyball because I played volleyball as a kid, and that was a big part of my childhood was watching the Nebraska volleyball team. Mm. Jordan Larson is a Nebraska volleyball player who is on the U.S. team. And then what I think needs to be added is disc golf.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I can do that.
I'm good at disc golf, and I could start my training right now to be in the Olympics for the disc golf team.
We can have a Sturmuseum Frolf team that makes it to the Olympics. Absolutely. Sam cringed a little bit. She didn't like that idea. Anyway, Rob,
no,
what's your answer?
I like the idea. I don't like the word.
You don't like the word Frolf?
Frolf.
Oh, that's controversial.
Yeah. I guess I'm a big Winter Olympics guy. I'm not that much into the summer ones. I like the bobsled. I like, I don't know what it's called, but the one where they're skiing and then they have to stop and like shoot a sniper rifle at a target and like keep going. However that got developed is the topic of a whole new podcast just in and of itself. But that one's pretty cool. The skeleton where they go down a slope head first just on a little board and are going 200 miles an hour. The games are just so unique, that which is makes them fun to watch as opposed to like the everyday sports that we're used to. So I just enjoy watching those more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But my cool story is something that has always been interesting to me, but I found out a little bit more about it, and it's the origin of the marathon and why we call it a marathon. There's an ancient story that Marathon was a town in Greece, and the distance between Marathon and Athens was about 25 miles. And essentially there in 490 BC, there was an important Greek victory over an invasion of a Persian army. And this messenger made that trek of 25 miles to inform the people of Athens that this had taken place. And he actually collapsed and died after giving the news. So like that tradition upheld. And in the 1896 games, the first reinstallment and the birth of these new modern games, they ran a marathon of 25 miles to, you know, tell that story, I guess, and keep it alive. It was actually changed to 26.2 miles in 1908 in the London Games due to royalty, and this really like just a little quirky story that they kept, which essentially said that the British royal family under Queen Alexandra requested that the race start at the lawn of Windsor Castle so that like the family could watch from the windows. Then the race finished where it normally would, which was in the front of the royal box of Olympic Stadium, which was a distance of 26.2 miles.
That's wild.
And then they just kept that. And in 1921, the length was formally standardized to 26.2 miles. And it's just been like that ever since, because this lady was like, hey, would you mind starting in front of my house? Because I'd really like to watch it.
Like, I understand that this is a tradition to commemorate a person that literally sacrificed their life to communicate this message. But I want to watch, and I don't want to leave my house. So change it.
Exactly.
When you were telling the first story, though, I had this flashback to a history class in middle school where we were told that exact story. Mm. So I was like, oh, yeah, I remember this.
Yeah. History is fun. I love little buried gems like that mm-hmm. that just like completely illuminate something. Those are the things I enjoyed the most in school with history, and I still enjoy them the most today, and I think they're what everybody really likes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The dates aren't necessarily the most important if it was 1776 or 1775 or July 3rd or July 2nd, but like...
But here's this really random fact to explain this arbitrary thing we still socially abide to today.
Couldn't have said it better. So on that note, why don't we hit pause? We'll take a commercial break, and when we get back, we'll be speaking with somebody from the Special Olympics of Nebraska. So stay with us, and we'll be back after these words.
Today's podcast is brought to you by A.J. Sousa Shoe Shop, located on South Front Street in Railroad Town, Nebraska. If you want fine dress shoes made to the latest styles, don't miss inspecting our stock. Shoes remade to fit your needs at prices most reasonable for your purse. Remember, Sousa Shoes in Railroad Town.
We are back with more of the Stuart Crazy podcast. We are joined today by Nate Parks from Special Olympics Nebraska. Nate, thanks for being on the show today.
Yeah, Rob, thanks for having me.
So the first question I have is just about you personally. How did you become affiliated with this organization, and what made you want to be a part of Special Olympics Nebraska?
Yeah, so I've been in my role, Vice President of Program here at Special Olympics Nebraska, for about 6 years. Prior to my time with Sony, I had worked in human services, working with people with intellectual disabilities. I'd done that for a number of years. I was the director of a service provider in the Omaha area for people with intellectual disabilities. And, you know, I was really fortunate to hear of the opportunity. I wasn't exactly looking at the time, but became familiar with the job opening and had an opportunity to sit down with our CEO, Carolyn Chamberlain. And, you know, we kind of hit it off and seemed to have a lot of the same, ideas and thoughts towards our population of athletes. And, you know, it just kind of worked out, and it's been a great fit for me. I have strong level sports, a background, as an athlete and you know, a lot of experience working with the population that we serve. So it's just been a great fit, very fortunate to be in the position I'm in.
What sports did you play as a younger man?
Yeah, so I played baseball, soccer, and football. But, you know, a huge sports fan, you know, love watching the Olympics as well. I coach youth sports myself, so it's been fun to be able to be a part of our organization here as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I know that that Sony is not directly affiliated with the Special Olympics. Could you describe that a little bit? How you both are sort of in the same boat, and what the mission of your organization is?
Sure. So Special Olympics is a global organization. Each program operates independently. So Special Olympics Nebraska operates independently of Special Olympics International or Special Olympics North America or Special Olympics Iowa, as an example. But we're all connected. We all share the same mission, and in terms of wanting to provide year-round sport competition for people with intellectual disabilities in an Olympic-style model. You know, we want to help develop physical fitness, create opportunities to demonstrate courage, experience joy, build relationships, and get involved in our communities. And, really, I think for those that want to make an impact with others, our organization is a great place to do that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think it's a great organization, and I'm guilty of saying that I hadn't heard of this division before kind of looking into the topic of this episode. I was hoping to kind of learn a little bit more about it from you, and just in terms of like who's eligible to compete in these games, and how what is the selection process and those sorts of avenues. Is there a link between Sony and the Special Olympics at large as well? Can you touch on some of that? Sorry, that's kind of a lot all at once.
Yeah, sure. So I'll start with just talking about eligibility. So here in Special Olympics, we have traditional competition as well as unified competition. So A special needs athlete, generally speaking, is a person that has an intellectual disability, and if you're 8 years old or above, you can compete in our competition. We have programming for children as young as the age of two as well, so we have different programming available for, you know, kind of those kids between two and seven, but once you hit eight years old and above, you can compete in different sports, and you know, we have like a traditional competition, which is for our athletes, and then we have our unified competition, which would involve both athletes and unified partners. And so an athlete is a person with an intellectual disability. A unified partner would basically be anyone else.
Gotcha.
And I think one of the common misperceptions of our program is that we're just for, you know, people with disabilities. But the truth is we have a place for everyone. And, you know, here in Nebraska, we offer about 20 different sports that you can participate in. We have more than 100 competitions a year statewide. And certainly not everybody participates in every single sport. You know, some things do happen kind of at the same time, and so you have to choose. But there are a number of people that might do as many as 14, 15 sports throughout the year.
Oh, wow.
You know, and you just kind of go from one sport to the next. It's an Olympic-style model. And we do some league play type things with our Unified Champion School program. But for the most part, you're practicing and training with your team for maybe about a two-month period, and then you're going off to either a regional or state competition, and you know, and then you kind of move on to the next activity or the next sport. So really, I think as far as eligibility, there's a lot of opportunity for just about anyone to get involved. It just kind of depends on what you're interested in, what you'd like to do.
Yeah, absolutely. So is when you said when somebody can advance to one of those regional qualifiers, is that sort of the next phase, and does that ultimately lead to you know, the Special Olympics at the national scale or at the international level?
Sure. So yes, we have our regional competition here in Nebraska. Our state's kind of divided up into four different regions, and that leads to state competition. And then if you want to go to what we consider higher competition, we have the Special Olympics USA Games and then the World Games. And for high-performance athletes, which is, you know, for every sport based on a specific criteria, there is a process that involves, you know, you winning to continue to advance. But for the most part, you know, winning at one level doesn't necessarily qualify you to move on to the next level. There's a lot that goes into it. You know, certainly an athlete would need to apply for, you know, to be a part of a Team USA or a Team Nebraska. You know, they have commitment to, you know, the time, the training, the travel, everything that goes
sure
into it, being away from your family. You know, and so there's certainly always a lot of interest in those types of things from our athletes here in Nebraska. And when everything's, you know, equal in the end, you know, sometimes we just have to kind of do a random draw to say, okay, we've got these three people that are, you know, eligible for this spot, and they all, you know, are certainly great candidates, and, you know, we're kind of having to draw a name out of the hat almost to decide who gets to go. And we also look, you know, who's had opportunities in the past, maybe who hasn't, you know, because we want to give people the chance to do something for the first time if at all possible. So it's not a one-size-fits-all process. And, you know, and every state does probably look at things a little bit differently. But for us, we've had a lot of success, and we've had a lot of athletes go on to do very well at the national and world level.
That sounds amazing. I know that Nebraska was fortunate enough to host the national games, at least, I think, in 2010. So I know that our state has had a great, you know, presence in this world. So I'm glad to hear that there's been quite a few athletes who have, you know, started from, you know, phase one and graduated all the way up through the process.
Yeah, and every time I speak to someone from another program, you know, they talk about, you know, hey, I was in Lincoln for the 2010 games. What a great event. People just were overwhelmed with the support, you know, that we gave locally for that event. And it really kind of set the stage for future events, because that was the second, technically the second USA Games that took place. And I think it really raised the bar. And the games since then have been, you know, bigger and better, I think, as a result of seeing what was possible.
Yeah. Well, like, if I could just shift gears for a second and talk a little bit about the traditions associated with the Special Olympics in Nebraska. I know there's a history that goes back over 30 years of a torch run. That's something that it has in common with the you know, Olympics that are every 4 years that we see on TV. But I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about that, the torch run that Sony does. for their games?
Yeah, so the Torch Run is really, it's a worldwide effort to, to create awareness, to raise money. It's a partnership with your local law enforcement. It started in Kansas in 1981, and here in Nebraska, we started in 1985. And we're really fortunate here in Nebraska. We have a great partnership with law enforcement, different agencies all across the state. And, it's just an opportunity for, like I said, for people to create that awareness, spread the mission of our program, and raise funds at the same time. And it, like I said, there is that connection with the run. And it's a big part of what we do. And there's a lot of different programming that goes into it.
Yeah, I don't know if you're familiar with the tradition of that torch run and how far it goes back, but I did some digging, and it actually goes back all the way to 776 BC, the Olympics, the regular torch run. And how they did that, they would just put dry grass in some sort of a vessel, and they would direct sunlight through a mirror that started a flame in Olympia, and they kind of they did their own sort of torch run from Olympia throughout Greece to different parts of the country, ultimately leading to Athens. And from that point on, the Olympics went away from, various generations, but came back in the 20s and 30s, and we've had that tradition alive all this time. So I just think that's a really cool thing that, both organizations can be a part of still.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. That's really amazing, actually, impressive.
Well, we do kind of a history podcast, so we have to slide in some of those facts here and there just to make it relevant and also tie in the past as well.
Sure.
So like you mentioned a little earlier that you that the organization has upwards of 20 sports. Was that right, 20?
Yeah, we have 20 different sports that we can compete in.
And I was doing a little bit of research here on what some of those games were, and a few of them, well, obviously, most of them sounded pretty, your routine, your baseball, basketball, those sorts of things. But there was a few that I didn't recognize, which is right off the top of my head. And I was wondering if you could shed some light on them and let me know if you've ever participated in them or seen them in practice. And one of them was snowshoeing, which I was not aware was a sport. Also, floor hockey, which I'm wondering if that's some sort of variation of roller hockey. And then also alpine skiing. Just living in Nebraska, I'm wondering where that might take place.
Yeah, no, those are great questions. And really, when we look at our winter sports, they're not as popular in terms of number of participants as it relates to other sports that we offer, in part because of where we're located and where you might practice and that type of thing. But we do have athletes that do snowshoeing, play floor hockey, do the skiing, both cross-country and alpine. We actually partner with Special Olympics Missouri and Special Olympics Kansas for our competition for those sports. The snow sports take place in Missouri each year around January, February, and then the floor hockey is actually hosted in Omaha. We run that event, and we get our volunteers from the University of Nebraska Omaha, their actual men's hockey team, come out and officiate our games.
Oh, that's great.
We have actually one athlete who is a snowshoer from Mid-State, a young lady who lives outside the Hastings area, that is currently under consideration for Team USA to participate in the World Games in Russia in early 2022 in snowshoeing.
Wow, so that's awesome.
Things that we do, and I personally have not observed anyone practice or compete in those snow sports. I've seen some video. We had an athlete from the Papillion area a few years ago that went to Austria, won a silver medal in skiing, and we've had some other athletes as well, like I said, that have competed at that level. But for those that do it, even though it's a small number, they really enjoy it.
Is that so? Like something like snowshoeing, I was kind of looking at the rules, and they're different, heats of different lengths of races, correct?
Yes.
So. Yep. Does there have to be a certain amount of snow down in order to really have that sport be played, or is it just kind of dependent on whatever weather you get?
That's a good question. I think it's really dependent on the weather you get. The competitions are generally held in locations where that's not as much of a concern, which is partly why we don't host those competitions here in Nebraska. So I think it just you do the best you can with with what you have, and you know, and for us, sometimes we have more snow in track season than we have, and you know, when people are really out there trying to ski or trying to do snowshoeing.
Yeah, for sure. We were talking about on the other segment of this episode, just sort of the games that have sort of come and gone in past Olympics. There have been things like pigeon shooting, just all kinds of crazy things that were, you know, sports for here and there. Another one was individual synchronized swimming, games that don't come to mind. I was wondering if over the history of Special Olympics Nebraska, or Special Olympics in general, if there have been those sort of sports that have waned in popularity or that are, you know, brand new and are really exciting to people in the modern age.
Yeah, no, and unfortunately, I think there has been. I mean, and we've seen some sports kind of go up and down in terms of interest and participation over the years. I'd say, you know, most recently, floor hockey is one where participation has gone down,
okay.
You know, for whatever reason, and the people that do it absolutely love it. We'd love to see some of our teams that play football or basketball take floor hockey up. But that is a sport that unfortunately is a little low on numbers right now. Roller skating is another one. Roller skating is really fun to watch. We've seen some really talented athletes out there doing it, but we've seen roller rinks close
sure.
more and more in every community over the last several years. Gymnastics is another where we just don't have a lot of people interested or participating in. So there are a few sports, and then we see other sports that are really on the up, up and up. You know, powerlifting is getting more and more popular every year. We're seeing more and more interest for flag football from our school-based programs and teams. Basketball is always very popular, and bowling is actually our most popular in terms of overall participants. So it, you know, it just kind of depends, I think, but we do see those numbers kind of go up and down.
Fair enough. The floor hockey, is that with a, do they use a puck? I couldn't find any pictures of that. I was just wondering if it was just on a gymnasium floor and there was a puck, or maybe is it like roller hockey where there's blades and a ball?
So there's actually two sports that Special Olympics offers that are fairly similar. There's floor ball and floor hockey. We play floor hockey here in Nebraska. Floor ball might look a little bit more like traditional hockey, where you've got like a hockey stick and a ball. With floor hockey, we actually have a stick that it's almost like it's a broomstick with the broom handle taken off. It's just, you know, straight pole, and on the floor you're using basically what amounts to a disc that has a little hole in the middle, and so you're putting the stick in that hole right in the middle, and you're kind of going around and you're trying to shoot it into a goal. And it's, you know, both are on a gymnasium type floor. Very fun, very physical. You're wearing a lot of the same equipment you might see in hockey, or something similar. But there's a little bit of difference between the two games. And I think floorball is becoming more popular across the world with Special Olympics programs. We've just been doing floor hockey for so long, that's where we're at. But you know, those are discussions that we have sometimes. You know, should we consider maybe floorball to try to gain more interest, or should we stick with floor hockey? It's just hard when we have a sport where maybe there's not a lot of participants, but they absolutely love it, and you don't want to take away something that somebody enjoys doing.
Sure.
So we haven't made any changes like that, you know, at this time, but that's kind of the difference between the two.
Yeah, absolutely. And sorry to kind of go down that rabbit hole. I'm really interested in unique sports. And when I hear about one that I've never encountered before, I just have a tendency to want to learn more and more about it. So I had to ask about that one. Well, I only have a couple more questions for you. I know you hit on a little bit earlier that there was one misconception that Special Olympics and Special Olympics Nebraska are, you know, weren't necessarily inclusive of everyone, but only a select few. Were there any other misconceptions that you come across in your, you know, day-to-day profession that you'd care to address right now?
Yeah, I think sometimes people underestimate the ability of our athletes. You know, they assume, well, that person's a specialist athlete, so they're not going to be able to, you know, compete at a high level in this particular sport. And then they come out and they say, wow, these athletes are really fast. This athlete can really swim, or this person, you know, is a great basketball player, whatever the sport might be. And then I think probably the most common thing that I hear is, you know, if someone says, hey, you know, what do you do for a living? And I tell them, and they say, oh, Special Olympics, when is that? You know, and it's,
yeah.
You know, so some might think that we're just a once-a-year track meet type event. And the truth is, you know, we just have, you know, ongoing opportunities to participate and compete in several different sports. And our athletes really do train and prepare for competition just like any other athlete involved in any other sport or organization at different levels. So I think those are probably the things that we hear. But once people get an opportunity to see our program, whether they're volunteering or coming out just to cheer someone on, they're usually hooked and, you know, they come back.
For sure. And we're happy to, you know, address those misconceptions and set the record straight as best we can on this podcast. Are there any major events or projects that are coming up right now in the near future for Sony that you'd like to tell us about while we have you?
Yeah, actually, we have our fall games coming up this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, August 7th and 8th. This is our first in-person state competition in a year. You know, since COVID hit, we really have not had a lot of opportunities to get our teams together for in-person competition. We've been able to do some things, modify some things, and have people practice and still participate in their sports. But we have four sports going on in Lincoln this weekend. We have our tennis competition on Saturday at Woods Tennis Center. We have softball taking place out at Mahoney Softball Fields on Saturday as well. And then on Sunday, we have a golf event out at Mahoney Golf Course, and we have our bocce competition out at Speedway Village. So we have four sports. We have more than 500 athletes and unified partners competing, which is a little less than what we usually would have for that weekend. But just with COVID, you know, everybody's kind of, you know, coming back at their own pace. But we're excited to get back out there and get back to it. And we hope that, you know, moving forward, we'll be able to continue, you know, with our events and, you know, as scheduled and do things with as few restrictions as we can.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like there's no limit to what's coming up in the future. And just want to say, Nate Parks, thank you for being on the podcast and wish you and the organization well.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
That was a great conversation. I really enjoyed talking about that topic.
Yes, although I am still frustrated that solo synchronized swimming was an answer. I've been thinking about it a lot since we filmed that, and I still think it should never have happened. But that's besides the point.
Those are some tough questions. I may need to rethink how tough I ask them in the future if that's a segment that we continue with.
I would like to get some correct next time, yes, to look a little smart at my job. But maybe some people at home who are listening along got some right. If so, let us know, or let us know if there are any other fun facts that you know about the Olympics and you can put our knowledge to the test.
Absolutely. We want to thank you for joining us on this first episode of Season 6 of the Stir Crazy Podcast. I can't believe we've already done this many episodes, but we are looking ahead to a lot of other topics coming up in the next coming weeks. And next week, we are going to be sitting down with the director of interpretation, Kay Sanova, and diving into the local subject of Shimmer's Lake and the Sandcrog Tavern in Grand Island history.
It's going to be a splash.
Yes. So join us again next Friday, and we will be diving in to the Sandcrog, hopefully not head first.
Have a good week.